guys. Welcome back to Portrait Session. This is Nick Page. I'm going to be your solo host this week. This week, we're going to be taking a bunch of questions that came through the Facebook group. If you're not already a member of the Facebook group, you should do so. Go over to Facebook and do a search for Portrait Session Podcast Listeners, and you can interact with us all there. So I just got back from Iceland. It was not as cold as you would expect. The ironic thing is we went to Iceland and the weather just completely fell apart back home. It was much colder and much snowier at home than it was there. We had such a great trip. We saw lots of aurora borealis in the last few days. Really, really strong, where it's taking up the entire sky. Got some really nice light at a lot of the iconic spots like Kirkjufell Foss. It was just an amazing trip. So anyways, just got back from Iceland, trying to get reacquainted with my time zone at home. And yeah, so let's jump into the first questions. Mark Morris asks, the vast majority of your senior portraits are environmental. Do any schools near you require a specific backdrop for the yearbook shot? I'm assuming you have a backdrop. Could you offer some specific brands for something nice and portable? So yeah, a lot of my senior shoots that I post online anyways are the big environmental portrait, or, you know, kind of a three quarters shot where I'm cropping somewhere around the legs. But I also, what I don't post a lot is I do take a lot of the, you know, more close up, just typical portraits of the person. A lot of times that's what the yearbooks want. They want kind of a vertical shot. They want more of a close up because, you know, they're not printed very large, and an environmental portrait doesn't look very good as a tiny little thumbnail on a page. Having said that, my favorite shots are the environmental portrait or the bigger shot. And also, when a family or a parent is going to print a really large photo, a lot of times those environmental portraits are the ones that they choose because they're printing it huge and it's okay to include more of the environment. I don't do like any senior portraits with a backdrop just because I feel like it's cheesy. But you know, a lot of times I am working with very simple backgrounds, but a lot of times they're all natural, whether it's a wall or, you know, some bushes or something in the background. So I don't use backdrops hardly ever anymore. I only use it for product photography. That's about the only time I do it anymore. Matthew asks, can you share your senior shoot lighting setups with us and maybe your camera and flash settings? When I'm doing senior portraits, I typically have two modes that I go in. I'm either going natural light and working with the light that's there and kind of doing the bright, happy, glowy look where I like keeping the sun at their backs and it's kind of a bright, overexposed kind of look. Or I'm going full on flash mode where I'm like really dominating the light and overpowering it. I don't know why I don't do a lot in between there, but I feel like I want my photos to have impact. And the best way to have that impact is to really, you know, have striking lighting. And so a lot of times striking lighting or impactful lighting to me means, you know, overpowering the light and getting that nice saturation in the sky or, you know, in the surroundings, or a real spotlight effect where the person's popping off of the background, or just having a bright, dreamy, glowy look. So that's, I guess, a slight tangent, but that's why I kind of have those two modes. So when I'm using flash for my seniors, typically I'm using my 38-inch Glow Parapop softbox, and I'm typically putting that on the end of a monopod and having either the parent or a friend of the person that's with me. There's usually always someone there, usually with the senior, and then I'll have them, you know, basically be my light stand. The most typical light directions that I use are I will have it straight in front of them, not off to one side, but up above, and then shooting kind of under it. That creates a very, it's really good for female faces where you're trying to light it evenly and nice and not create a whole lot of harsh shadows on the face. And I'll get that as close as I can manage without it being in the shot. Sometimes I'll even have it in the shot and then edit it out in post. But if I'm going for more of a moody kind of casting shadows across the body or across the face, I will put it off probably 45 degrees off to one side, still up above them. I always have the light higher than their eyes, or at least the bottom part of the modifier, even with their eyes. That way the majority of light is coming down That way you're not creating any weird up shadows. And then I'll have them kind of turn their face towards that light. And that what that's going to do is it's going to cast light into both eyes. You're getting catch lights in both eyes, but you're still creating shadow across their face, across their body, and it's creating dimension and mood. And a lot of times I find that when I'm having them look off camera to one direction, that's also the side of the frame that is closest to the edge. So if they're looking to their left, that's going to be where the edge of that frame is. And that's kind of turned into a Nick thing. And it's not your typical correct composition. Normally you have them looking towards the larger side of the frame or the side of the frame that has the most space. But for whatever reason, when I'm doing those really moody portraits, I like them to look the opposite way and it creates a little bit of tension. So those are the most typical. A lot of times I will also add a backlight, which is typically just a bare speed light, and just kind of adding a little rim light to them. But the majority of my light is coming from a large softbox as close as I can get it, and it creates that kind of dramatic yet soft light. Devin asks, what was your favorite part of your Iceland trip this time? This one is easy. It was definitely when the Aurora Borealis popped out. I have shot the Aurora Borealis, but never up north where it's just taking up the entire sky, and I never got to watch it dance across the sky. And that has to be on the bucket list of every single photographer because it was just amazing watching it literally dance across the sky and move. It was hard to take photos during because you just wanted to watch it so much. It was so beautiful. So that has to be it. That was a serious bucket list item for me that I got to cross off a couple days ago. Erica asks, you are awesome at every genre of photography. Well, thank you. She says, what is your favorite genre to shoot and why? So I talk about this pretty often. One of the reasons that I feel like I don't get burnt out as quickly as I would otherwise is because I shoot so many different types of photography. And, you know, weddings, they're addictive because they pay well. And I feel like I'm pretty decent at, you know, a lot of the wedding portraits. But for me, like, my happy place is definitely landscape photography because it's my chance to kind of have a little bit of alone time and just slow down and enjoy the process of making photos rather than just trying to bust out as many photos as you can in a given amount of time. Sometimes I feel like portrait photography is very much like, okay, you have 1 hour to make as many good photos as you possibly can. Ready, go. And I kind of hate that. I hate that aspect of it. So landscape photography is a good chance to slow down, get away from people a little bit. And it ends up being really therapeutic in a way. It's kind of like Nick's Zen time. So it's definitely landscape photography for that reason. But landscape photography does not pay my bills. And I can only do it so much. And then I start getting picky about light. And like, you know, I'm only going to go out when the light is perfect. So it's definitely got its downsides as well. Rob asks, would love some tips on detail shots for weddings. Okay, so when you're at weddings and you need to get those detail shots, whether they're like, you know, the jewelry or the food or, you know, the centerpieces on the tables and stuff, the first tip that I have is try to isolate the subject and tell a very simple story. So a lot of times that's just using a really shallow depth of field. That way you're really drawing the eye to the only part of the frame that's in focus. That's a really easy way to isolate the subject. Sometimes it's just being very cautious about distracting elements. Like if you're shooting jewelry, you know, lay it out on a table and then shoot flat straight down. Make sure you're using a very simple area to do that and just try to eliminate distractions. And then the next tip is to try to tell some kind of story with it. If you can not only isolate your subject, but to have a background that is helping your story. A lot of times that helps, like, you know, if you're shooting the bride's shoes and then you have the wedding dress out of focus in the background, stuff like that. That makes for a much more impactful, compelling photo than to have a door out of focus in the background. Really pay attention to your backgrounds and make sure that you're telling as much of a story as you can. So isolate your subjects, make a simple photo with a clear subject, and try to tell a story. That those three things will really help a lot. Also, it does help when you actually light some of these things. Like a lot of times, one of the things that I do different than a lot of photographers is I will actually light the cake. You know, I'll have Annalise, my assistant, with a, you know, with a softbox, and we'll actually take the time to light it. And it looks like it was lit in some kind of studio. And a lot of photographers don't do that. They just walk up, snap a picture of the cake, and that's what people get. And little things that like that can really set your photography apart from other wedding photographers. Okay, what is your trick for taking fun, cool, epic family portrait photos? So I'm assuming you're talking about when I go on trips. I'm not very good at remembering that, to be honest. Like I get in such photography mode that I oftentimes forget to take photos of my family, and that does not make me a very good father, probably, but it's true. But when we do stop and do it, a lot of times I'm photographing a beautiful, you know, scene, and just throwing your family in this landscape photo that you've already set up can really make a huge difference. It can make for a really good family photo. Like, for example, I have family photos from Boardman Tree Farm. I was there photographing it. I was like, you know, we should probably just go stand out in the middle of this shot for a couple. And shooting it with a wide angle lens with a cool sky, it really helps. On those family trips, and you've got this nice scene in front of you, just throw yourself and your family out in front of it. Make you guys look small and show the whole scene. It really, those are memories that you end up remembering for a long time. Annalise asks, how do you get your beard to look so awesome during photo shoots? Does it get in the way when changing lenses? Thanks so much, Annalise. Thanks for that. Well, it doesn't always look good. That's the true answer. But a lot of times I have bad hair days, bad beard days, and it's going in every single direction and I look homeless. So I can't say that it looks great at every photo shoot, but it does not get in the way of changing lenses. I have very long arms. Morgan asks, I'm curious about your workflow from client contract to image delivery. It's not the funnest topic, but I really want to nail my client management. My client management works like this. They typically fill out a form or send me an email through 17 Hats. Then Jesse, my assistant, answers any kinds of questions, and then they nail down a date. And for most of my portrait photography, I'm not doing contracts yet. It's probably not the best practice, but I only am doing contracts for my weddings at this point. And then once they agree upon a date, a lot of times some of my shoots require a deposit. They pay the deposit, that nails down the date. We do the photo shoot on that date. On the day of that photo shoot, the rest of the payment is due, or the payment is due. And then typically 2 weeks later, I'm delivering through Pass, and that's about it. Yeah, it's pretty simple, really. But most of the client interaction is happening with Jesse, and there's typically quite a few back and forths, nailing down times and stuff. And in that amount of time, I'm asking, you know, what kind of look are they going for? What kind of setting are they looking for? And that helps me pick locations and pick times and dates and stuff, and working around that. So not doing contracts, although I'm not sure that that's the best practice, but that's kind of Nick's way. Nick does everything the easy, kind of lazy way. You guys should probably be using contracts. So Ed asks, what do you do for business development? Is it all word of mouth? Do you have types of shoots that are key to introduce you to people, then other gigs that are byproducts? For example, you shoot high school sports, and then that gets you into senior portraits, which leads you into engagements and weddings. Is this accurate or not? And yeah, it definitely is. When you're shooting lots of high school sports, that is great for introducing me to all the kids. I develop friendships with a lot of the athletes, and then I end up doing their senior photos. And I don't do any source of marketing other than word of mouth and Facebook. Those are the only two ways that I ever market myself. And that's great for overhead. I don't have to pay for marketing. I don't have to do a lot of that kind of stuff. And if you're just really clever about making sure that you post and that you tag, in my experience, one shoot always leads to the next. And granted, it's seasonal, like January is very dead for Nick. I'm actually stressing a little bit, but You definitely have those months where you can't do enough shoots to get everybody in. Then you have those months where there's just no shoots coming in because photography oftentimes, depending on where you live, is very seasonal. But when I shoot a wedding, I make sure to tag everybody that I can. And then I ask people to tag people that are in photos. So everybody's getting tagged. People see those photos. They see, oh, wow, this guy's such a great photographer. I want to book him for my engagement shoot. And then that engagement shoot leads to a wedding or vice versa. When kids get see their friends get really good photos, they want really good photos, too. And one shoot always leads to the next. And that's kind of the way that social media is working. As Facebook kind of limits your reach more and more, I think that Instagram is going to be a great way of going about that, especially for senior portraits, because seniors are typically using, or people of that age group are using Instagram more than they're using Facebook these days. And it's so photo driven that I think it's a great way for us to market ourselves. So just make sure that you're sharing, you're posting, and you're tagging, and that's typically going to lead to the next shoot. Aaron Taylor asks, if you could talk to the Nick Page at the beginning of your photo journey, what would you say to him? That's a tough one, Aaron. I think that I would remind that person to have fun. Remember that it's not all just, you know, it doesn't have to be hard work. I think sometimes that I've taken it so serious that I've sucked some of the fun out of it for myself because I'm so driven to improve. Also, I would remind him that you need to charge for your time. I'm notorious for undercharging for a lot of stuff that I do because I've talked about many times on the show before. I grew up poor and I've done real work all of my life. And now that I get to make the amount that I do, it's really hard for me to charge what I'm worth. And just because other people that are not as good as me charge a certain amount, it's hard for me to feel good about charging what they do just because they do. But you know, starting cheap and then building it up and charging more and more and more, that's a very painful, difficult process. It's much easier if you start off charging maybe more than you're worth and then just kind of keeping it the same as you improve. That's a much less painful way of going about it. But at the same time, you're not going to do nearly as many photo shoots and you're not going to get better as quickly because you're not doing as many photo shoots. So it's, I don't know. I guess that I'm not sure that I would change that, but it's definitely made for a painful growing process to charge more and constantly go through those periods where people are asking you for quotes. And the first time that they're like, ooh, I can't afford you. At least with me, I get that little pang of guilt, like, well, maybe I am charging too much. It's an important step. It's just a painful one. Annalise asks, okay, real question. Pretend I'm asking as Barbara Walters, how has your photography style evolved from the beginnings 4 years ago? And where do you draw inspiration when you've had back-to-back shoots for months on end? That's a great question. When you're doing lots and lots of photo shoots, you tend to just get stale and you feel like you're doing the same thing over and over and over again, which you probably are doing the same thing over and over and over again. So in the beginning, my style was, I was just trying to be cool. I was trying to make my photography stand out. I wasn't really trying to emulate anybody per se, but I did know that I wanted it to be different and flashy and interesting and dramatic. That's kind of always what's been inspirational to me. And so I would learn a new trick, I would overdo it, and then I would slowly dial it back. And that's gone for every type of photography I do. Now with my portraits, I'm trying to have my portrait photography kind of emulate my landscape photography. People love my landscape photography so much that I want to incorporate that and incorporate some of those post-processing tricks that I've learned through landscape photography and put that into my portrait photography, which not a lot of portrait photographers do. And I think that that's starting to give my style kind of a refreshing. It's got a its own thing going on. A lot of portrait photographers don't know all of the stuff that an advanced landscape photographer knows. They don't know about luminosity, mass, and they're not using that stuff. So it's kind of giving me a slight edge in that way. So I would encourage people that are feeling a little bit stagnant with their photography to maybe look outside of their style of photography. Like if you're a portrait photographer, look at landscape photography. If you do something else, you know, look at a completely different genre of photography and then draw inspiration from that. And I think that's going to make your photography different than the crowd and evolve it in a way that it wasn't going before. Keith asks, besides improved photography on YouTube, who or what company were your biggest influences when you got started? So I watched a lot of lynda.com for a long time, and there was several guys on there that I really enjoyed. I love Ben Long. If any of you are members of lynda.com, Ben Long is probably my favorite person over there, just because his sense of humor is really dry and he adds just enough humor into his videos to really make a dry subject fun. And his videos are really good for the beginner who is kind of learning all the different foundations of photography. And then after lynda.com, I kind of felt like I outgrew it for a while. And then I moved over to the Kelby videos, and I really liked Joe McNally's videos a lot. Joe McNally is just, he's so good with speed lights. I really enjoy his use of speed lights. And yeah, so portrait photography, those were definitely the early inspirations. And I really like the lynda.com stuff. Debbie asks, I've been doing some research on how to focus in low light, and I keep coming across using your Speedlight's autofocus illuminator instead of the camera's autofocus assist lamp. Does this really help? Pros, cons, just a myth? And do I use this technique? So Debbie, yes, it does help a whole lot. The reason that it's better is because it sends out a pretty large grid of crisscross lines, and that gives your camera a whole lot more to focus on. I use this technique all the time. Works pretty well in situations where people are not moving too quickly. When people start to move, then it doesn't work so well. Wedding receptions, it works really great. Problem is when people are dancing and getting closer and further away from the camera. A lot of times those autofocus lights only work in one shot. They don't work in continuous or AI servo focus modes. So it works really well for stationary targets. Another option is just to have somebody off to the side with like the light from their cell phone and put a little side light on people, and boom, you can focus really well. So that's another option there. Justin asks, going deep here, life plus business equals what? How does your business affect other areas of your life? Being a one-man show means you really have to keep food on the table, and it's like all up to you to keep food on the table. How do you accomplish this with still build a rewarding life? The thing about being self-employed is that you're going to work way more hours than you would if you were just working a 9-to-5 job. So then the question becomes, can you still lead a rewarding life? Can you have a family and do this? And the answer is yes. And it also means that you're going to be working some strange hours. For me, a lot of times I work from before my son gets up until he gets out of school. Then I try to be a dad until he goes to sleep. And then once he goes to bed, I do some more work. And then I work a few more hours. And then I work every single weekend. So I really have those hours from when my son gets out of school to when he goes to bed. And that is my social life. That is my family life. And the rest of it is business. And luckily, I have the coolest job in the world, and I don't mind. How often do you get to say that you get to travel and get paid for it? It's pretty cool. I'm so incredibly fortunate to have the life that I have. So if you love what you do, if you love the type of photography you do, you're going to be happy with the quality of your life. But if it's not really for you, you're quickly going to get miserable because you do the same thing all the time. And there's not a whole lot of variety in your life unless you're doing lots of different types of photography or whatever. Those people that quickly get burnout, I think it's because they don't truly love what they're doing. And in that case, you should keep keep whatever job you have and not be a full-time photographer, because you really have to love photography in order to do it all the time, every day, every weekend. Michael asks, limitations of portrait photography with Micro Four Thirds cameras. Olympus, like the Olympus OMD Mark II. I would say the main limitation of portrait photography with, you know, Micro Four Thirds is depth of field. You know, you're having to use, in order to get that shallow depth of field, you have to use an aperture of, you know, 1.4. With full frame cameras, it's just so easy to get that shallow depth of field. You're able to use, you know, the sharpest parts of your lens and still get a shallow depth of field. I can easily shoot my 70-200 f4 or f5.6 and still get tons of separation between the client in the background or the person in the background, with no effort at all, really. But with Micro Four Thirds, in order to get that same shallow depth of field or that same separation, you're having to use apertures like f1.4. It can be done, but it's definitely nice to not even have to try to get that nice shallow depth of field. Also, if we're talking weddings, there is the low light performance. A full frame camera just does better in low light. It just does. And I could not, I could shoot weddings with a crop sensor or a Micro Four Thirds sensor, but the quality is not going to be as good. And it's just not going to be as good. So that's probably the biggest advantage of the full frame sensor, is that it does so much better in low light. Okay, so Rob, very last question asks, he says, do you use luminosity masks to dodge and burn with people? So I am using luminosity masks in some of my portraits, namely those big landscape environmental portraits, but I'm not so much doing it to dodge the people. I am doing it to blend in a sky naturally. So I will have my bright exposure, I'll have my dark exposure, using layer masks, paint in my sky, and then I'll use luminosity masks to make the transition from the dark exposure to the bright exposure in a natural way. And that's really where luminosity masks help so much. So yeah, I guess you could word it like I am using luminosity masks to dodge the people. But mostly I'm using it to make that transition area as natural looking as possible. And a lot of times you just cannot do that by hand or with any other method, or especially just by selections. So yeah, I am using luminosity masks in my portraits. Okay, thank you guys so much. Hopefully there has been a few nuggets of information here, and it's good to be on again. It's been a while. So thank you guys so much, and we'll see you in another 7 days. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
The views expressed on this program by independent hosts, guests, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views of Improved Photography LLC or its advertisers. Some links mentioned on this program are affiliate links where a commission is earned.